to Resounds, arts and culture on the high plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
As filmmakers Stan Parker and Pete Tolton believe in the power of story to spread empathy and understanding, by giving audiences the chance to step outside their lives for even a moment, film presents opportunities for fresh perspective, thoughtful reflection, and personal discovery.
Stan and Pete came across a great story and traveled to Vietnam with Jim Markle Jr. and Jim Markle Sr. to revisit the places Jim Sr. was stationed during the war.
Stan Parker is an independent journalist and filmmaker based in Billings, Montana. His most recent experience in documentary film include working as a producer, camera operator, and post-production technician for Makoshika in 2015. Previously, he directed Banking on Trust in 2012.
And Pete Tolton is a Billings-based filmmaker. He's an artist, a writer. His projects center on community engagement, small business, history, and music. He's currently managing digital content and video over at Montana Gallery in Billings. And his experience also was working with Stan on Makoshika. He was the production manager.
Stan and Pete's latest project is a documentary film focused on the father-son duo of Jim Markle Sr. and Jim Markle Jr. as they traveled through Vietnam to revisit the places Jim Sr. was stationed during the Vietnam War.
Stan, Pete, great to have you in the studio. You have just returned from Vietnam, and I'm curious, when you accompanied this father-son duo, what was it like? Because Vietnam isn't necessarily of your era. What were your experiences or maybe your preconceived notions before going to this area and then after?
Not having grown up during the Vietnam era, of course, being born after it, that put us in a position where we wanted to be really humble and ask questions and be slow to form impressions and really soak it all in. And so, of course, we have a concept of this period in time because it was hugely changing for our country, and we've lived with a lot of the changes to culture and to interpretation of history and of kind of the way that people think about things, both in the U.S. and in Vietnam and elsewhere. We tried really hard to kind of bring with us a blank slate and let the experience inform itself and, not come across with any assumptions.
Yeah, I mean, our entry point to this story was really through Jim Jr., who Pete and I are friends with and have done a lot of work for in the past. And, you know, the genesis of us getting involved in this story was, you know, Jim Jr. telling us that his dad was finally talking about Vietnam, really for the first time, was ready to return to the country, and that maybe we could film this whole thing and be along for the ride. And I could just tell by the tone of his voice that this was something extremely important to him, that this part of his dad's life that had been sealed off for so long was about to come out. And the more we've told people about this project, the more we've found that similar stories about other, you know, Vietnam veterans who never talked about it. So many times when we tell us about this project, we hear, you know, like, oh yeah, like my dad never really talked about Vietnam. My uncle never really talked about Vietnam. My grandpa never really talked about Vietnam.
Well, and how unique to have them both having served in the Marine Corps, of course, in different eras, but to have them both with some military background. And then also that father-son bond, that must have been a really, at times, probably very emotional place to enter for them both.
Yeah, absolutely. The Marine bond was very strong. You know, the whole time we were on the trip, they were talking about, you know, sharing stories about, you know, shenanigans from the Marine Corps. Or, you know, an important distinction is that Jim Sr. joined the Marines, enlisted in the Marines after Vietnam. He was an officer in the Army during Vietnam. But they, you know, that armed forces connection really ran strong within their family.
So this is a big project. I'm interested in how you go about even taking on a documentary in a foreign country. Pete, you talked a little bit about the research that you did and trying to approach the project with a blank slate. But in terms of production and fundraising, how did you go about making a commitment to do the project?
It was certainly something we discussed quite a bit and knew that once we decided to go for it, it would really take over our lives. I performed the first interview with Jim Sr. back in the fall of 2016, and we reviewed that over Christmas of that year. So it really takes a long time, and it takes a while for it to show itself, for the identity of the project to form, and for you to really realize what you're getting yourself into. And of course, a project of this scope and magnitude, I don't mean that it's incredibly important necessarily, but for our lives, you just have to let it be dominant in your life. And so that means putting a good faith effort that it's going to get made. And of course, you asked about fundraising, and that really has the biggest effect on how quickly it'll get made, because, you know, we're passionate enough about this that it'll come out, certainly. But if we reach our fundraising goals, it'll come out in a more timely manner. So that we're in the middle of that, and we're always balancing producing the film, editing, fundraising, looking forward to distribution. We're spinning many plates at once.
You guys have worked together in the past on Makoshika. What was that experience like for you both, Stan?
You know, I think that Makoshika was, you know, a lot of fun, in that it was four friends trying something pretty impossible. I don't know. I mean, not impossible, because, you know, we did it, and a lot of people do it.
But you weren't necessarily focused on documentary filmmaking in the ways that you are today, correct?
You know, Makoshika was my, you know, the second documentary I worked on. I did, you know, Banking on Trust was the first thing I did right out of college with some friends. And, you know, I think that, you know, one thing that all these projects have in common is, you know, you're working with people that you like and know and trust because they're your friends, and they feel really scrappy in a lot of ways. You're really trying to pull together all the resources you can to tell a story that you think is important and needs to be told. I think with each subsequent project, things get a little more professional, and you start to realize the things that with each film, you start to like have more and more characteristics of professionalism, but still you realize where you can keep it scrappy when you need to.
Yeah, I suppose that you would understand the resources needed to accomplish something, and it seems like you really escalated this to head all the way over to Vietnam.
Right. I mean, Makoshika is not a well-known place in Montana, but it's not that far away. Vietnam, it's a long ways away, and it's an entirely different culture, different language. How was your trip to Vietnam in terms of the logistics of doing a film in a foreign country?
It was a lot to look forward to and a lot to plan for. I'm not a natural-born planner. So, of course, the night before we left for a 4 a.m. flight out of Billings, I stayed up all night packing and preparing my house so that someone else could move in while I was gone. I ended up being gone for 2 months. And, you know, to set life aside to go do that is huge on itself. But then to go somewhere that's so different, it was shockingly and delightfully different than life here, for sure. Every bit of stimulus is something unusual. And so your days are just rich with interesting sights and sounds and characters. And we had fabulous treatment by our guides in Vietnam. And speaking of logistics, we certainly couldn't have done that without Vin, our primary guide, and Hai, our driver, and then the various local guides along the way. So we covered quite a bit of territory all the way from Saigon or Ho Chi Minh City, and then south a little bit to the Mekong area and the Chu Chi tunnels, up the coast to central Vietnam, touching on the DMZ. Jim Sr. crossing the DMZ was his first time entering into what was, at the time of the conflict, North Vietnam. And then we went down and spent a lot of time in the Central Highlands. So that's a lot of different areas. That's a lot of territory to cover. And of course, you know, we're still have to take care of ourselves as human beings rolling down the highway in this huge van. And fortunately, we all got along and we all had tremendous experiences. And what we didn't shoot on video, will inform the rest of our lives.
I'm curious what you did shoot on video. You must have countless hours of footage. Well, I'm sure it's countable, but what are you going to do with all of that? Is it a monumental undertaking to go through all of that footage?
At first, it always seems that way. Like at first, it's seeing this giant mass of footage in front of you and not really knowing which thread to pull on first.
How many hours do you think you have?
We have about 120 hours.
Wow.
But I think that there's a certain process to it that you can do to keep yourself sane during this. And there's part of editing that is, you know, a creative process that you want to be in the flow, in a flow state when you're editing and just pick and choose elements to sort of tell your story the way you want to. But if your footage is disorganized and you can't find anything, then that's a frustration that breaks that flow state pretty quickly. So the idea is to, you know, go through these really concrete tasks that you can do, you know, organize things by date and time, organize things by scene. You know, you can like edit little assemblies together that are just like compilations of nice footage. And these are things that you can do just sort of as a rote task that don't require that creative energy so much. But all of the, and you know, making transcriptions of all of your interviews and all of your scenes, and then you can like pick through those to identify the moments quickly. And that way, when you're in that creative state, your organizational library is just at your fingertips enough that you can, that you don't get frustrated when you're in that creative mode.
Pete, I'm very interested. I saw in a preview clip where you had interviewed Jim Markle Sr., and he said at the age of Vietnam, when he went, he really wanted to be there. It was very important for him to be there. Is this the first time he had been back? And was that, how was that experience, taking a man who had suffered PTSD from Vietnam, going back into a country that created that problem?
For Jim Sr. to have appreciated the work that was being done by U.S. military in Vietnam at the time, and to really want to be a part of that is so far from the place that I come from, and also telling stories about people following their passions might be just the best kind of stories to tell, you know, because they are, they're so driven by something identifiable. But what makes him a complicated character as well is that by his accounts to us, his philosophies about the reasons for war and about a single soldier's involvement in it have changed in the nearly 50 years since he last left Vietnam. But yes, he signed up. He was very interested in returning to Vietnam after his first tour. He was there in 64 to 65 as a radio operator and door gunner, general enlisted army, and then went back and after he had completed special forces training and went back in 69-70. And to go with somebody who was had such strong impressions from his time in the war and who has such strong linguistic abilities, he was really deeply invested in his time there, both with the Vietnamese people and with the Montagnard people, who are the indigenous tribe he was embedded with and served with. So he was a great guide and a reflection point for someone who enjoyed their time there, believed in the mission they were doing, was willing to learn the languages, but also came back afterwards and had time for reflection and change to the point that it drove him to return.
I know that it's uncomfortable to talk about Vietnam. Jim Jr. mentioned this about his father as he was growing up, having a hard time talking about that, especially with these issues of PTSD. And they wanted to go there not only to get to know one another a little better, but to get to know a bit of that history and to inform Jim Jr. about his father. That trip helped them deal with the past, or at least that was their goal. Do you think that that was accomplished?
That's a place where I'd be careful not to speak for them, but by the impressions that I have of their relationship and a sense of, you know, there's a father-son relationship there. There's a soldier to soldier relationship there. There's a lot going on, and going back to Vietnam for Jim Jr. meant going back to the place, the kind of this mysterious place his father was when he was away for very long periods of time. And Jim Jr. had a bit of a rough and tumble childhood, and so he's very self-reliant and very strong and scrappy in a different way than Stan said that before. But really was wonderful seeing them come together on this trip and see a lot of questions get answered for both of them.
So taking on a project like this is emotionally very powerful. And I'm wondering, as film directors, how do you bring out that emotion that makes for a powerful documentary and at the same time keep your distance?
You know, I think that this is something that's particularly hard with this film, you know, being that, you know, we already considered Jim Jr. a friend before this process started and, you know, obviously became even closer to Jim and his dad during the course of traveling so closely with them for 3 weeks. And, you know, I think that one of the things you want to keep in mind, or one of the things I try and keep in mind is, you know, always thinking back to the story. When you're making your filmmaking decisions, to always come back to what's best for the story.
But certainly maintaining any kind of distance was a challenge. I mean, we were traveling very closely with them. We all ate together and got along very well, and we were really a pretty tight unit. So many of the things that our documentary subjects were experiencing, Stan and I were also experiencing, but just on the other side of the camera.
I love this quote that you have included in some of the materials about the film, which is from Mark Twain, that travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. And I love that idea that getting into another country opens you up so much to experiences that are completely outside of your own world. Do you find that this process has changed you as filmmakers and as people?
Stan here. I mean, I think the answer to that question is yes, but in what way? I think it's still hard to articulate at this point. You know, obviously we went on the trip for me was 3 weeks long, and through that learned so much about the Vietnam War, about Jim and his dad, about the indigenous tribes and the places that we went, and have a lot to reflect on as far as the reason for war, what war does to communities, and, you know, how individuals stuck in those situations react to each other, and also realizing that there are so many different perspectives in any story. You know, there's a lot of people like to say that there's two sides to every story, and I think it's more accurate to say that there is as many sides to a story as there are people involved. And I think it's just, especially when you're doing something as so deeply emotional as wartime experiences, it's a lot to process, and I don't think I have a good answer for how it's changed me, other than maybe humbled me and caused me to be more patient with my opinions and judgments and just always seeking to learn and explore more, I guess.
And Pete, you took a longer trip. You were gone for 2 months, so it was a little bit of business and a little bit of pleasure, too. Talk about your experiences traveling when it was perhaps not documentary-focused, when you got to maybe just experience things from a curiosity standpoint.
After Stan and the Jims went back to the U.S., I ended up spending a lot of time with a very talented young Vietnamese filmmaker named Quang. And he's a great drone pilot, camera operator. You know, he kind of does it all, and ended up being my de facto translator, fixer, and close friend. We traveled together extensively, and so I was able to spend time with someone who, in many ways, is like me, works in this same industry as I do, but really get an on the ground impression of what life is like over there, kind of in a way an analog, you know, for me. And to see that some of the stories that we were pursuing, the places we were going, especially some of the more remote areas outside of the towns and cities and into the hills with the Montagnards, was as unusual for him perhaps as it was for me, because he's a city kid. So that was really a great reminder that no matter where you are, what you're doing probably isn't a common experience for people who live near there anyway.
So that brings to mind, it's been a long time since the war, and I'm wondering, this may come out in your film, but what is the perspective of the people in Vietnam? I mean, were you welcomed in to tell this story? And did you find they had stories that they wanted to share?
I think it really depends on who you ask there. I mean, there's definitely the official government version of the story, which they share in the museums and in the plaques and in all the historical sites there. And of course, we all know that the North won, and so that's their perspective. But it really comes down to a personal experience. We had one local guide who went by Mr. Joe, and Mr. Joe was short, had a ton of energy, very loud, always called Jim Senior General. And he showed up to greet us at the airport in a Make America Great Again hat and would not let us call Ho Chi Minh City Ho Chi Minh City. We had to call it Saigon. And, you know, his experience with the war was one of, and he is a Montagnard person, you know, of the indigenous tribes up in the Central Highlands. And, you know, his experience was that the American soldiers were nice to him, and he said they'd always follow the jeeps around because they'd throw candy and treats off the back, and that the Viet Cong would throw them bullets and grenades. So he has a deep reverence for the Americans' role there, but of course, you know, that's his perspective. And on the whole, I think that we felt very welcome, you know, even by, you know, another guide whose uncle was part of the North Vietnamese Army. And they started talking about that, and with a smile on his face, he goes, "Oh, my uncle was NVA. He was your enemy, but it didn't seem hostile." That war hurt that country very profoundly and tore families apart who were, you know, on various sides of the war. And in order to move past that, they've, you know, had to be very good at burying the hatchet, so to speak. So I can't speak for what's going on in their heads or behind. Or behind their words, but on the surface, it seems like that country has, you know, had a long time to work on how to live past that war.
And what a good point that you can't speak behind their words. You really do have to take at face value what you're receiving as you go over there with cameras and with a goal in mind. And did you find that people were very willing to be videoed and to speak to you? Or was it more like, hey, guys, off the record, I'll tell you?
I think our interest in being heard here in the U.S. is maybe stronger than it is there. And people, well, of course, there's some censorship of what can be on recorded with audio and video. And so that was sometimes hard to tell the difference between what people were uncomfortable with sharing personally and what they just didn't want to be caught saying, I suppose. But it was really striking to see how many different ideologies and philosophies are still present in that country, where many people were against the war. Many people were pro Vietnamese independence, even if that meant communism. Some people are bona fide communists. You know, some people are Catholic. Some people there's just quite a spectrum there, and of course there would be. Why, you know, this isn't a homogenous. This isn't a place where everyone thinks the same way just because there's a unified message coming out of the government.
On a learning curve, is the story that you thought you would tell different now from the story that will make it into the film?
There's a famous filmmaker who said that if you tell the story you set out to tell in the beginning, then you weren't listening. And so we had an idea really of what we wanted to explore, the questions we wanted to ask, and where we wanted to go. But looking at a long and complicated relationship between father and son, affected by military service, looking at getting back in touch with Montagnards, retracing steps from where Jim Sr. went in the war and reconnecting with a place that was very important to him, we certainly checked all those boxes.
Well, and back to Stan's point, too, that you spend a lot of time listening in documentary work. And it sounds like you guys have a ton of great stories that you could pursue. We really appreciate your time coming into the studio and talking about this experience. And we really look forward to the release of the film. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains is produced by Corby Skinner, Anna Page, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Additional funding provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. More information on Resounds is available at ypradio.org.